Good evening, friends. Franz Weinschenk here to welcome you to Valley Writers Read. We've got two wonderful stories for you tonight. First, we're delighted to present a tale by Bob Hudgens entitled Mulberries for Mohammed. And after that, you'll be hearing a story by Fresno author Jerry Fisher entitled Lily and Her German Soldier. But to get us started, here is David Otero to read Mulberries for Mohammed.
Mulberries for Mohammed. When a job at Fresno State brought me to the Central Valley 4 years ago, I felt like an immigrant who had just washed up on alien shores. Even though I had been born and raised in the Bay Area, I had been living out of state for several decades and didn't know anyone in Fresno. As I struggled to find my way around and settle into Valley life with its backyard swimming pools, air quality alerts, and circling police helicopters at sunset, I was reminded of an incident that had occurred 25 years ago to another transient, struggling to find his footing in a foreign land. But to understand that connection, you have to leave Fresno and travel with me back in time into the heart of Africa. Back then, I was living in Zambia, a landlocked country in the middle of the African continent, a few countries above South Africa. A job had also taken me there as I struggled to build a career in agricultural and rural development. In Zambia, I was stationed about 6 miles outside of the town of Kabwe, at what had been a British agricultural research center during their colonial period in that part of Africa. The research station was roughly 2 hours north of the capital city of Lusaka, along the Great Northern Highway, which by U.S. standards was really just a ribbon of two-lane asphalt running through the African savanna due north to the Copper Belt, from which Great Britain had extracted much mineral wealth over time. Although straight, and for the most part flat, the lack of shoulders made the road seem uncomfortably narrow. The encroaching savanna seemed eager to repair the scar and regain its lost territory. Even driving in Zambia was a foreign experience, due to the British legacy of driving in the left lane, passing slow traffic on the right, and substituting roundabouts for stoplights, which made every road trip an adventure. The town of Kabwe was a small commercial center along that highway, established originally to exploit a local vein of copper. Mining had begun more than 80 years prior to my arrival on the scene, so only a few aging remnants remained of the former British colonial presence back when Zambia and what is now neighboring Zimbabwe were formerly called Northern Rhodesia. The golf course, a clubhouse, squash, and tennis courts, though tattered and weathered, were still standing, along with a few spacious and decaying colonial homes. It was easy to image life during that grander period with Europeans in safari hard hats and khaki vests swigging sundowners on their verandas while watching a full moon rise slowly over the slag heap in the distance. To anyone driving along the Great Northern Highway, Kabwe was just a collection of shops, gas stations, and a few local restaurants. Of course, being in the heart of the African continent, the streets were crowded with people whose skin pigmentation was so extremely dark that the palms of their hands were purple and the whites of their eyes were yellow. Only a handful of people of European descent remained in town. They were either expatriates like me, working in the mine, the railroad, or in agriculture, or they were the children of the British colonialists, for whom Kabwe and Zambia were home by birth. In fact, white people were so scarce amid that black mass of humanity that we joked about being a few grains of salt in a pepper shaker. Kabwe's only claim to fame occurred in 1921, when the skull and a few bones of a 200,000-year-old common ancestor to both Homo sapiens and Neanderthals was unearthed 20 meters below the soil surface during mining operations. The Broken Hill Man, as the partial skeleton was named, was the oldest human remains found to that point in time. The presence of us white-skinned Muzungas, which translates as aimless wanderers in Swahili, was definitely an insignificant blip in the broader expanse of evolution in that ancient and timeless place. There were two other Americans on the project in Kabwe. It was the first experience in Africa for all three of us, so our heads were full of stereotypes and preconceived notions of life on the Dark Continent. Each of us was assigned a rather spacious, single-story tract house in the White Compound of the old colonial research station. A Kaffir compound, as it was called, housed the African laborers a short walking distance away. The tiny one-room tin buildings in the Kaffir compound, with a lean-to kitchen outside and communal latrines, made the houses in the White compound seem like mansions. But by American standards, our three-bedroom houses and indoor plumbing were modest. The houses we were assigned hadn't been occupied since Zambia had attained independence from Great Britain 18 years earlier. At that time, the majority of the white population had either returned to England or moved to join other former colonialists in Rhodesia, as it was called then, or South Africa, where apartheid still reigned. A new coat of paint and some imported American furniture, which seemed very out of place in that setting, made the interior of the houses comfortable. But the yards outside were wildly overgrown with waist-high, bone-dry grass. Fortunately, the native flat-top savanna trees had survived the years of neglect, so the large, spacious lots had intermittent shade and small islands of green surrounded by sun-bleached grass. The scene reminded me of the green oak trees dotting the yellow California foothills in summer. But it was obvious that much effort and patience were going to be required to tame the African bush and convert it into flowering bushes and lawn. For lack of television and other entertainment options, I became fixated on yard work. The grass was too tall and thick to mow. Instead, I decided to solicit nature's help by constructing a small fire break around my house and front yard and striking a match. Even without the slightest wind, the dry grass exploded into flames, which spread with lightning speed in all directions. In horror, I raced around it, stomping furiously. But just as I would manage to extinguish one segment of the widening sphere of angry combustion, hungry fingers of flame would leap laughingly in the opposite direction, determined to outrun me. Fortunately, the fire break held, and no trees or other structures were damaged beyond a smudge. Eventually, I was able to contain and extinguish the fire, but not without a few intense minutes of neighborhood excitement. Fire is actually an essential component of prairie and savanna ecosystems, so my attempt at ground clearing stimulated the growth of new grass, which, with water and frequent mowing, gradually transformed itself into a lawn of sorts. Water pressure on the station was laughable by American standards because groundwater had to be pumped into small tanks situated atop termite mounds, which were the tallest earthen structures in the vicinity. From the termite mounds, water was then distributed to the houses by the force of gravity. So water pressure depended on the distance of your house to the nearest termite mound. The resulting trickle out of my garden hose wouldn't even drive a sprinkler. So I would just lay the hose on the ground and let the water sink in at its own African pace. I brought along with me some American flower seeds, which, to my surprise, germinated quickly in the warm subtropics. While perusing the general area around the station in a project pickup truck, I discovered an outcropping of lateritic rock nearby. Laterite clay, which is rich in iron oxides and aluminum, hardens upon exposure to air. The resulting rust-red rocks look like free-formed bricks. I filled the bed of the pickup truck several times and used the rocks to sculpt flower beds and walkways around the yards. Within a year or so, a landscape gradually began to take shape, setting my house apart from my neighbors. I even had a go at the wild mulberry thicket that had colonized the far corner of my backyard, entangling itself in bramble bushes and grasses. It was gnarly and determined to survive, just like the British settler who first planted it there decades ago. You could tell just by looking at it that it had an ornery and unruly character, and it wasn't about to obey or even give up its fruits without a bloody good fight and many purple-stained fingers. Aside from a distant refrain of, "Here we go round the mulberry bush," from a long-forgotten nursery rhyme, mulberries were as exotic to me as everything else in my new surroundings. I also vaguely remembered that mulberry leaves were a food source for silkworms in Asia, which made the tree seem even more exotic. In my boyhood home in San Leandro, my parents had planted boysenberry vines along the back fence, which led me to believe that all berries grew on thorny vines, not bushes or trees. Live and learn, I thought, as I went about harvesting the reddish mulberries. While they were rather bland in both taste and sweetness, their presence livened up the dinner plate. So I tended the trees as best I could and competed with the birds each year for the ripening berries. Like the other houses in the white compound, the yards of the house next door were equally unkempt and wild with tall, dry grass and thistle. I had heard a rumor that an oilseed specialist, who was expected to arrive soon from Egypt, would be occupying that house. In Africa, as in many parts of the developing world, words like soon have a much more laid-back connotation, basically meaning someday or maybe. Even the word far, used to imply a measure of distance, required repetition in a sentence when the distance was pronounced. I would frequently slow my pickup truck to ask pedestrians along the dusty back roads if the next village was far or far, far. Then I would respond with a long, ah, as if their answer had clarified my understanding. Of course, far, far could just as easily mean across the border in the next country. When a dark-skinned figure in a long, flowing white robe caught my eye one afternoon in the backyard of the house next door, I realized my new neighbor had arrived. When I first saw him, he was alone, strolling slowly as if surveying his new and badly overgrown domain. He looked somewhat bewildered and stunned, but he was not alone for long. Godfrey, my long-legged and very sociable African cat, had spied him long before I did. I watched from my bedroom window as Godfrey sauntered over with his tail held high in a banner of friendship. Upon arrival, he rubbed his cheek on the stranger's ankle, leaning in with his full body weight as he did so. The stranger neither shied away nor reached down to pat the feline, as most Westerners would. Actually, it came as no surprise to me that Godfrey would be the first to spot and befriend anyone who ventured into his territory, but I was captivated by the scene of a cat leaning affectionately into the long, white, flowing gown with his black tail wrapped around a chocolate leg. They stood together in that pose for several seconds, as if surprised at the disorder around them and contemplating strategies to conquer the alien terrain. It occurred to me that Godfrey had given me an opportunity to rush over and introduce myself to my new neighbor. But as I watched, the stranger separated himself from his new feline friend with a gentle nudge of his foot and returned indoors. I was ready and waiting when he reappeared later that afternoon to stroll slowly around his yard with his hands folded behind his back. His head was bent forward as if in some inner sanctum of memory, in a safer place, in another incarnation where he was of value and loved. I wondered who and what this frail, out-of-place figure had left behind. I pictured dusty desert scenes, pyramids, a sluggish gray-green Nile River lined with lush papyrus reeds. For all I knew, he could just as easily come from the huge, busy metropolis of Cairo, or maybe Alexandria with its towering Roman ruins. By coincidence, the mulberry tree was in fruit at the time, and the harvest bountiful. Mulberries would make a nice housewarming gift, I thought, wondering at the same time if mulberries would be as much of a rarity in Egypt as they are in the U.S. It would be just my luck that mulberries had a less than flattering reputation in his culture, like trying to win the affection of a young lady with a bouquet of dandelion flowers. Surely my American English would be as novel and incomprehensible to the Egyptian as his Arabic would be to me. Would we even be able to communicate in anything other than smiles and bows? These questions morphed into a visceral fear in my head as I quickly washed, selected the most handsome mulberries, and placed them in a bowl. Then I took a deep breath and set off in his direction. My movements seemed sluggish and in slow motion, and I felt very conspicuous and unsure of myself. Was I approaching too fast? Was my fixed smile too obvious and insincere? What would he think of me? He froze when he saw me approach, the airy veil of his white frock clutching his lower legs as his body twisted in my direction. He sensed a foreign encounter, and his mind probably raced with the same flight impulse and uncertainties that had coursed through me in anticipation of this meeting of East and West. Surely I would address him in a foreign tongue that he had yet to master. Surely I would assault him with silent value judgments and preconceived interpretations of his background, religion, even his hygiene. He seemed wary, and his eyes widened, adding to my awkwardness. I spoke first from a safe distance. I can't remember exactly what chatty words spewed out, but it was an impromptu mixture of hello, welcome, that's my cat. I live right there. I'm American. The pitch of my gibberish even sounded unnatural to my ears, and about one octave higher than my normal voice. Speculation was still written across his face. Maybe I'm speaking too fast, or maybe he doesn't understand my American English, I thought in a panic. Maybe my clothing is too risque or indecent by Islamic standards, or maybe I shouldn't be touching the plate of mulberries with my left hand. Oh, which hand was the eating hand and which was the wiping hand in Islamic culture? I used to know that, I thought as the cultural chasm between us grew. Meanwhile, as if on autopilot, my legs had continued to steadily propel me onward across the no-man's land that divided our yards, and suddenly we stood face to face. Our right hands automatically reached out to grasp their counterpart, our gaze locked to each other's eyes, seeking out some deeper acknowledgement or sentiment that trivial words could not convey. The fear of confrontation was replaced by pleasant smiles. I heard myself say, "Bob," and I heard the word "Muhammad" come from his lips. What a strange shadow that handshake between Bob and Muhammad must have cast on that ancient African soil. When I extended the bowl of mulberries, his smile broadened with an understanding that radiated throughout his entire being. "Yes, yes," he said, and I sensed the muscles in his shoulders relax. As he gestured back towards his house with one hand, he asked, "Coffee?" Suddenly there were no language barriers, no locked doors to keep out the perils of the dark night, no fences separating neighbors, and no armed border patrols. That awkward choreography of body language and smiles had succeeded in establishing a fragile connection of sorts, at that most human of levels. He seemed to be suddenly invigorated as he danced ahead of me into his house, throwing all the windows open wide, allowing in the warm sunlight and fresh air. I could easily feel myself in Mohammed's sandals when I moved to Fresno. I, too, was a stranger in a strange land. People were certainly pleasant and happy to conduct business with me when money changed hands, but nobody sensed my unease or reached out to provide comfort. Like Mohammed, I just busied myself with blending in as best I could, but home was still somewhere else, distant in both time and definition. There was plenty to do to fill my days, but loneliness in the evenings and weekends began to eat on me. After a few casual cross-fence conversations, I had learned the names of my immediate neighbors, but little else. Whenever our paths crossed, we would smile and exchange waves, but I spent most of my time imprisoned in my own solitude. Of course, I was in my native country and culture, so I was able to adapt relatively quickly to my new locale. I was soon swept into an active social network. Through new friends at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Fresno, I was introduced to the Blossom Trail, hiking in Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks, the Pacific Coast in the heat of mid-July, and the wide variety of restaurants and entertainment options in Fresno. In time, I was invited into homes, met local families, and began to put down my own roots in this community. But it took several years to shake the stigma of feeling like a misfit and an outsider. I quickly realized I was not the only transient in a multi-ethnic setting. Fresno was full of immigrant groups and people who had moved here from other parts of the U.S. They had all struggled to adapt to the local lifestyle and cultural norms while pursuing a better life. I saw their acculturated descendants every day on the campus of Fresno State. Hmong, Chicanos, Armenians, Iranians, Koreans, Thai, and Chinese, among others. Bright-faced young people in transition, with each foot planted in a separate culture. I would often see them huddled together with others of similar ethnic backgrounds as a reprieve from the pervasive process of cultural assimilation. One day, a work crew of Chicano gardeners was mowing and tending my neighbor's lawn. I had seen them in the neighborhood many times before and had noted how several of them were shorter, darker, and thinner than the common caricature of the plump Mexican under the wide-brimmed sombrero. I learned from friends that they were from Oaxaca in southern Mexico, near the border with Guatemala, and they had come to the U.S. to avoid the political violence and extreme poverty of their homeland. They were actually descendants of the Mayans, and Zapotec or Mixtec was their native tongue, not Spanish. For them, English and American cultural norms probably required a greater adjustment than for immigrants from northern Mexico, who we commonly associate with Cinco de Mayo festivities and blaring mariachi bands. Most of the Oaxacans were uneducated, and many were classified as undocumented aliens. They had braved the dangerous land journey alone to find employment as gardeners, roofers, and day laborers on jobs that did not appeal to most Americans. They were all extremely hardworking, industrious, and dedicated to even the most unpleasant and demeaning task, and each month they sent a large portion of their earnings to their families and children back in Oaxaca. But as a minority within a minority in this land of great opportunity, they appeared to be shy, withdrawn, and fearful. I sensed that they were experiencing the same psychological ordeal that I went through upon arrival in Fresno, but their transition was exacerbated by ethnic prejudices and suspicions brought on by fears of terrorism, the competition for jobs in the Great Recession, and the anti-immigration fervor that was brewing in Arizona were spreading nationwide like a cancer. Their concerns were well-founded. Frankly, America has become a very paranoid and unfriendly place for refugees, especially those whose appearance and mannerisms contrast to ours. Prejudice and distrust abound. Racism and ethnic profiling crouch in shadows. When times are tough, everyone needs a scapegoat, and in California, Chicanos are an easy target. With Muhammad in mind, I decided some good old down-home American hospitality was in order. So late one summer afternoon, I approached one of the lawn maintenance workers, who had the most distinctive Indian features, smiled, and greeted him in Spanish. My Spanish, though conversational from several years of living in Latin America, was far from perfect, but it was probably more comforting to him than his second language, English. Hola. ¿Qué tal? ¿Qué calor hace hoy, no? I said as I walked in his direction. He paused his steady work cadence, and in his hesitation, I saw the same perplexed facial expressions, the flash of the same alarm that I observed in Muhammad all those many years ago. But like Muhammad, he gradually relaxed, shook my hand with a firm, calloused grip, and rested uneasily on his hoe. When he told me his name was Juan, I thought to myself, well, that will be easy to remember. But as I was doing so, his last name flew by me and vaporized beyond memory. He agreed that the day was indeed very hot and humid, and as if on cue, we both wiped sweat from our brows in unison. I offered him a glass of cold water, the basic chemical element inside both of our bodies despite their exterior differences. I was hoping that he would accept my attempt at Spanish as a gesture of friendship, meeting him halfway in an honest attempt to bridge the great divide between us, to break down the suspicions we held of each other. We stood together under the hot Fresno sun, chatting about nothing of consequence, but the more I spoke, the easier speaking became, and the more receptive he seemed. The words themselves were not important, and the understanding they conveyed was probably imprecise, but their impact seemed to dissolve and dispel the tensions and suspicions that had been palpable between us only a few minutes before. And when, in the natural course of the conversation, I inquired casually where he came from, to my surprise, he gestured with one arm toward the south and said, far, far. Yo sé, hermano. I know, bro, I said as casually and reassuringly as possible. I know exactly. Later, as I walked back to my house with the empty glasses, I thought about all the Juans and Mohammeds out there feeling alone and adrift just like I had felt, standing out in the crowd, all different, yet in matters of the heart, all absolutely identical to everyone around them. I thought of how desperate we humans can become for the simple comfort of an extended hand, a caring smile, any gesture that acknowledges and respects our existence. And I realized that I am truly grateful to both Muhammad and Juan for reminding me of our common humanity. I would like to think that right now, right this minute, they are reciting their experiences and their personal tales of American kindness to their children in their own languages, in sounds that are so strange and unintelligible to our ears. ¶¶
la que tú presentas bajo de ese traje. Oaxaqueña de los ojos negros y la piel morena. Cuando bailas en la guelaguetza cubierta de encajes, yo te admiro y por ti suspiro al verte danzar. Juchitán de la región ismeña.
That was David Otero reading Mulberries for Muhammad by Bob Hudgens. It's a memoir about how the author, while working in Africa, made a friendly and peaceful connection with a person obviously from a totally different culture and background. The author then relates his African experience to a similar encounter in Fresno, where he made a comparable bond with a gardener who was a Oaxacan Native American from Mexico. He tells us about his wish to make these kinds of connections in the following words, quote, "I thought of how desperate we humans can become for the simple comfort of an outreached hand, a genuine smile, any gesture that acknowledges and respects our existence." And now for our second story, which is authored by Jerry Fisher and which she entitles Lily and Her German Soldier. Here's Carolyn Carter to read it for us. Lily and Her German Soldier.
Lily and Her German Soldier. Strains of deguttered Dämmerung fill the courtroom as the prisoners file into the docket. Someone with a macabre sense of timing has arranged for a symphony orchestra made up of survivors from the death camp to perform for the tribunal. It is 1947, and 40 ex-guards from the concentration camp at Auschwitz are to be tried for war crimes. My name is Lily. I am a Jew. I am in Krakow, Poland, to testify. I close my eyes and the memories of that dark, gloomy day in 1943 flood over me. The same music was playing then. I was only 17 when I stumbled off the train onto the ramp at Auschwitz, holding tightly to my mother's hand. We were herded onto a large platform surrounded by German guards, barely controlling their snarling dogs. Loud music playing Wagner came from an orchestra at the far end of the platform. A huge sign read, "Arbeit macht frei," translated, "Work will set you free." After spending 3 days with 124 other prisoners in a small boxcar with no water and no sanitation, I gasped, my lungs screaming for air. Some didn't make it. They died or went insane. My father was one that didn't live through it. He was trampled to death. He just gave up. The lines moved slowly, meekly, like lambs going to a slaughter, until an SS officer separated us, the men to the left and the women to the right. Babies and children were allowed to stay with their mothers, but before long they divided us again, culling out the children, the handicapped, the elderly, the weak, culling out my mother. I ran up to the guard. "No, no," I screamed. "That's my mother. She's with me. Where are you taking her?" He was very courteous, answering me with a smile, allaying my fears. "Don't worry, Fräulein. You can visit her. Visiting hours are on Sunday." I never saw my mother again. The rest of us were marched to barracks. I walked with my eyes half closed, oblivious to the bleak surroundings. Numb with shock, I mumbled a prayer. "Where are you, God?" Inside one of the barracks, an emaciated scarecrow of a woman said, "Come, you can share my bunk since they shot my bunkmate this morning. My name is Sarah." My eyes filled with tears and I stumbled. She caught me, patting my shoulder with a skeleton-like hand. "Go ahead and cry. I have no tears left. But be careful. You mustn't do anything to get their attention. Don't ever look them in the eye. They are monsters, and they will make your life miserable, or have you gassed. Keep your mouth shut and do as you are told." The barracks were lined with triple-tiered wood bunk beds, each shared by more than one person with a thin blanket between them. There was no heat, no toilets, no water, and we were filthy, literally crawling with lice. Rats as big as cats attacked the dying. The latrines were rows of holes cut in concrete slabs above waste pipes. We slept and worked in the same clothes we arrived in. Roll call was at dawn. Breakfast was bitter coffee and a piece of stale bread. Work days were 11 to 12 hours with lights out at 9 p.m. The guards entered our barracks at will and spotted the ones unable to work, then shot them or sent them to the gas chambers. When Sarah found out I had been selected to work in Canada, she explained where the name came from. They call it that because it is known as the Land of Riches. You're lucky. Everyone wants to work there, but they usually pick the young, pretty ones, like you. They won't shave your head because you'll be meeting the trains and sorting the belongings of the new arrivals. They do everything to keep the newcomers placid and quiet, so they won't know what awaits them and they'll be easy to handle. What do they do with all the things they bring in, I wanted to know. The photos, mementos, Bibles, you know, personal things, are burned. The rest is taken to Canada, where it is sorted out for shipment to the Reich. You will also go through the confiscated suitcases, trunks, and personal items left behind in the gas chambers. It's a gold mine because these people bring in jewelry and money, even food. They say the wife of the commandant regularly ships packages from Canada to her friends in Germany. I soon came to realize it was good duty compared to the half-dead, starving men and women in the rest of the camp. Sarah explained to me that the guards were SS, the Schutzstaffel, originally Hitler's bodyguards, but now responsible for carrying out the final solution, Hitler's plan for the elimination of the Jews. They were a disciplined, armed elite, racially pure Aryans forbidden to marry anyone who is not also racially pure. Sarah said a law passed in 1938 made sexual intercourse between an Aryan and a non-Aryan a crime punishable by execution. It was called the Law for Protection of German Blood. Be careful, Lily. Watch your step at all times. They'll shoot you for looking sideways at one of their pure little Aryans. She spat on the ground. I was surprised one day when one of the SS guards at work came up to me and shyly handed me a raw potato. "Here," he whispered, smiling at me, "I brought you a present." Keeping my eyes lowered, without a word, I slipped it into my bra. That night I wrapped the treasure in rags and slept with it under my body, hoping that my body heat would soften it. The next morning I ate it, still half raw, guiltily savoring every bite. The weight was falling off me. I was so hungry and the long hours were torture. I didn't care. I wanted to die. One day, the entire camp had to stand at attention for 8 hours in a cold, drizzling rain, forced to watch while they hung 20 prisoners as a reprisal for killing one Nazi guard. Many died of pneumonia from this. I prayed I would too. My shoes were worn out, held together with strings and bits of rags. The SS officer that gave me the potato arranged for me to work at the shoe pile. This was a mound about the size of a two-story building of just shoes, women's shoes, children's shoes, beautiful shoes, ugly shoes, shoes stacked as high as a small mountain. I was busy sorting them when he came over to me with a pair in his hands. They were sturdy but attractive. He motioned for me to put them on. "Pretty feet need pretty shoes," he said with a friendly smile. Without a word, I obeyed, and from then on came to work each day wearing a pair of worn-out shoes and returned to my barracks with a nice, newer pair, which I gave to another prisoner. Sometimes they were much too large, and I would stuff them with soap or underwear or even food. My heart pounded so loud I was sure the guards could hear it, but they never made me take off my shoes during check. I was aware of the prisoners being gassed. I had only to look through the fence to see the line of Jews waiting to be taken to the gas chambers. And the smell. Sarah told me they buried them at first, but there were so many the ground began to heave and turn red. The decomposing bodies were actually bursting out of the earth, forcing the work details to dig up the restless remains and burn them. The sickly smell of that and the crematoriums permeated the air, and the smoke clouded the sun. One day I was working at the shoe mound when the friendly SS officer slipped me a note. Without looking at him, I took it and the first chance opened it. My hands were trembling and I wondered if I had angered him. The guards could be sadistic. It was short but to the point. It read, "My name is Eric. I know you are Lily." Tearing the note into 1,000 pieces, I decided to ignore it. Often after that, he would show me some act of kindness, but I never acknowledged it. "I would rather die than have anything to do with a Nazi pig," I told Sarah, who looked at me as if I had lost my mind. "You're a fool," the old woman replied. "He can save your life. At least don't make him mad." "But he's the enemy. He is also a Gentile. I hate him." "Think about it, Lily. You must do anything to live, even be nice to a Nazi." "How can you say that after you've seen what they're doing here?" "Because someday this will be over." "Now who is the fool?" I answered. "We will all die here." While working on the ramp one morning, I happened to see my sister with her 2 children get off one of the transports. There was a huge crowd, and the line was creeping along, so without considering my own safety, I ran up to the officer who had shown me so much kindness, frantically beseeching him. For the first time, I called him by name. "Eric, look, it's my sister, please, over there. With the 2 children? Please save her. You can do it. It's my only sister. Oh, my God in heaven, please, oh, please, I'll do anything you want. Please, I beg you." I started to get down on my knees. He grabbed my arm and moved me to one side. "Point her out to me," he whispered, "and I'll do what I can." The day wore on as I watched the crowd move slowly through the selection process. With a sigh of relief, I saw my sister chosen for the Canada Brigade. It had to be my benefactor to have arranged it. My tears of joy became tears of agony, and I almost fainted when it became evident that the 2 children had been sent to the gas chambers. My sister was hysterical, finding small solace at that moment with the saving of her own life. Later, the guard slipped me a note. "I'm sorry about the children. I could do nothing." I thanked him over and over. I wanted to kiss his hand, but I only said, "I know you did all you could. Thank you. Thank you." At least he had saved Ruth. I felt differently about him now. I caught myself staring at him. "He is kind," I thought. "He is not like the others." I was able to find decent dresses for me and my sister, and there was often food to be stolen. Eric turned a blind eye to this, sometimes sneaking us treats. As the miserable days wore on, I began to look forward to seeing him, this blonde Adonis, this one kind person among the monsters. He was the epitome of the German soldier, the so-called master race, with his deep-set blue eyes, surprisingly kind eyes, corn-silk hair, and a tall gracefulness. I would study him, grudgingly admiring his looks, blushing when our eyes met, and he would smile at me. The beatings and degradation by the other officers and the bleakness of my life was broken by the kindness of this officer. Some of the women collapsed under the blows of the cruel guards, but Ruth and I seemed to be protected most of the time. This guard was the one bright spot in my life. The noonday meal was a cauldron of a thin turnip soup with tiny bits of meat and potatoes in it. Some of the prisoners held back before taking their portion, hoping to get a bit of meat when it settled to the bottom. Many times Eric slipped a piece of bread or a potato to me, which I shared with Ruth. We were so hungry, so grateful. I was working alone, cleaning and polishing a box of shoes for shipment one day, when he came up to me. "Lily, come here." I followed him to the back of the shoe pile where he handed me a piece of sausage. Something about this small act of kindness made me cry. After the crowded barracks, the lack of toilet facilities, the brutality of the other guards, the stench that permeated my very being, to have someone be nice to me was more than I could handle. I couldn't stop the tears. He hesitated, then walked over to me and pulled me into his arms, soothing me, holding me, while he let me cry. For a moment, I felt safe. He never said a word, but I could feel his heart beating beneath that hated Nazi uniform. After that, when we found ourselves alone, he would take me in his arms and hold me close, stroking me, telling me to be strong. "My beautiful Lily, you must be very careful. I don't want anything to happen to you," he kept saying over and over. I hated the filth we lived in. I felt like I was crawling with lice. How could this man desire me? When I told him I would give my soul for a bath, he nodded. "Of course, I'll see what I can do." Days later, when ordered to the shoe detail again, there was a bucket of water with a towel and a bar of precious soap. I closed my eyes and plunged my head into the fresh, clean water, taking great gulps of the liquid, more priceless to me at that moment than gold. As I bathed, I tried not to dirty it too much so Ruth could also enjoy this treat. Days later, I was at the back of the shoe pile again when he came over to me. We stared at each other for a long moment, then ignoring the danger we were in, I went into his arms. He held me, whispering, "I love you, Lily. Don't you know I care for you? I love you. Tell me you love me." I looked up into that gentle face. "Oh, Eric, I do. Of course I love you. How could I not? I do. I do." Pushing me up against the wall, he kissed me again, gently, tenderly at first, then again, ardently, encircling me with those strong arms. I leaned into him, returning his kiss with a dark passion that surprised both of us. A tingling heat enveloped me. For a moment, I forgot the dreariness and helplessness of my life. With all my heart, I wanted this man. I got up the courage to tell him so. "Make love to me. I want you to make love to me." "Lily, my darling Lily, you know what will happen if you get pregnant. They'll send you to the chambers. We can't take that chance." "I don't care. I'm going to die anyway. I love you. I need you. I don't want to die without us being together. Let's take what we can. I can't live like this. You're the only reason I hold on. If it wasn't for you, I would already be dead." "Oh, Lily, I do want you," he moaned, kissing me again and again. I returned his kisses, feeling like I was drowning in the exquisite pleasure we were able to give each other. Pulling him on top of me, relishing the weight of this man on my body, the warmth of another human, eagerly straining against him, for a brief time, my living hell turned into a sweet existence. "Oh, God, forgive me. Oh, God, thank you. Dear God, I thought you had forgotten me. Dear God." Afterwards, as we lay there entwined, he petted me, pressing against me, telling me how he would always love and protect me. I started to cry again, my body racked with sobs while he consoled me, holding me against that strong male body, making me forget the danger we were in. Rumor had it another guard and prisoner had been executed when they were caught together. But we met every time we could after that, our passion only heightened by the danger. The seasons melded into each other, one horrible, degrading day like the next, until 1944. He held me while he told me that the Russians were advancing, and he feared he would be sent to the front. "Lily, if they send me away, I won't get a chance to tell you goodbye. It could happen any time now. This war won't last much longer. You will soon be free." I clung to him, not able to imagine my life without him. Sobbing, I cried, "If you leave, I shall die. I cannot bear this without you. Oh, Eric, my darling, my life, don't leave me. If you go, I'll never see you again." He tried to calm me. Don't give up, Lily. You must not give up. The Fuhrer says we have a secret weapon, but things look bad. Now listen carefully. If you can, get away before the Russians get here. They will rape the women. They are animals. I can't stand the thought of what could happen to you. The dreaded day came when he was not on duty. I searched frantically, afraid he had been sent to the front, terrified to ask any of the guards. I didn't want to live anymore. I thought about killing myself, but how could I leave Ruth? Rumors were flying. It was late 1944, and the Germans had begun hastily destroying equipment and records. But they continued rushing prisoners through the crematoriums. Death did not take a holiday, and the transports kept coming with their human cargo. One overcast morning, there was no roll call. We arose to silence. The guards had gone. We were free. In a stupor, we stared at each other, not sure what to do, not sure if our hell on earth was over. Heavy artillery could be heard in the distance, so we figured the Russians were advancing. Most of us were as afraid of them as we were the Nazis. Remembering what Eric had told me, Ruth and I decided to run. When we came to a nearby village, it was almost deserted, so we went into a house and helped ourselves to food and drink and a heavenly bath before heading onward, finally ending up in a displaced persons camp on our way to Great Britain. I made it. I was free. Because of Eric, I was alive. A brother in Great Britain took us in. We both had nightmares for a long time, and it was hard to speak of our ordeal at Auschwitz. In my dreams, I searched for Eric, but I could never find him. I was mesmerized by the trials at Nuremberg, eagerly devouring the papers each day. In 1947, I read the former commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Haas, had been sentenced to death. The trial for the staff and guards would be held in Krakow, Poland, in November. My heart sank. Would Eric be one of the prisoners? Was he alive? I had to know. I immediately wrote for a list of the guards on trial, and there was his name. "I have to go. I have to help him," I told Ruth. She was aghast. "You can't go back there. Oh, God, Lily, think of all the memories it will bring back. It's over. You must forget him. You can't save him." He saved us. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. They say 6 million Jews perished in the Holocaust. We would have if it hadn't been for Eric. I must go. I arrived in Krakow on the first day of the trial. It is with difficulty that I got to see Eric. He looked tired, with dark circles around his eyes. Is he ill? I strangle a sob. My heart was breaking. I wanted to take him in my arms and console him. Our hands touched through the bars. "Hello, Lily." How can I tell you how I felt? How can I explain the look on the face of this man I had loved so passionately? If my coming accomplishes nothing else, that look is worth my trip. Thanks to my testimony, Eric was only sentenced to 7 years. Most of the guards were sentenced to death, some for life. As they took him out of that courtroom, he turned and gave me a smile and a little half-salute. Although my heart ached and I knew I would never see him again, I felt good. He had saved my life, and I saved his. I'll never forget the nightmare of Auschwitz, and I'll never forget Eric. I returned to Great Britain and later married a wonderful man who gave me 2 beautiful children. I write this so they will know my story and know about my German soldier.
That was Carolyn Carter reading Jerry Fisher's story, Lily and Her German Soldier. As we heard, it's about a Jewish girl during World War II who, along with millions of others, was imprisoned in a German concentration camp, in this instance, Auschwitz. And even though she lost almost all the members of her family in the Holocaust, she and her sisters were saved by a German guard who had fallen in love with her. After the war, she came to the rescue of this guard by testifying on his behalf. He received a sentence of 7 years, while many of the other guards received much longer, some even death sentences. Here's the way she puts it. He saved my life, and I saved his. Friends, our first author tonight, Bob Hudgens, although currently teaching at Fresno State, has had a very busy life indeed, working in many different parts of the world. He refers to himself as a hobby writer and has published several stories in Life Story magazine and in Volume 2 of The Americas. Thank you for your story tonight, Robert Hudgens. We hope you keep them coming. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our author will be Gary Soto. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.